ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly wrap of global news in arts and culture. I'm Daniel Browning. Well, after nearly 2 years and the scrutiny of four separate investigations, the Remote Arts Anti-Collective, at the heart of breathless claims of white interference in black art, has been cleared by a Commonwealth regulator. After a shocking video emerged purporting to show a white art advisor painting a canvas by a senior artist, the Australian newspaper published a slew of articles, nearly 100, triggering an extraordinary series of events. We'll unpack those events shortly here on Arts in 30. And with more festivals cancelled and the fewest Australian songs in the hottest 100 in almost three decades, we look at the problems and solutions facing the Australian music industry. But first, the headlines with Skye Kirkham. Skye, what have we got? The Smithsonian's closed their diversity offices. It's just a domino effect.
It is. Last week, we reported that the National Gallery of Art in America was ending their diversity programs following an executive order by President Donald Trump, which requires all federal agencies and departments to end their DEI programs within 60 days. The Smithsonian Institution, which includes 21 museums, 14 research centres, and even a zoo, has followed suit, closing their diversity office and pausing all federal hiring. The Smithsonian Secretary described the closure of the diversity office as a first step to address the new federal policy.
And Europe, major renovations are in store at the Louvre?
The museum made headlines recently when a confidential memo written by its director, Laurence Descartes, was leaked to the press. In the memo, Descartes said that visiting the Louvre is a physical ordeal, and warned of a proliferation of damage in museum spaces and alarming temperature fluctuations endangering the conservation of artwork. Now, the French President Emmanuel Macron has announced a major renovation work, a new renaissance, which could cost up to 800 million euro and triple the capacity of the museum. The Mona Lisa will be placed in a room of her own. On the downside, ticket prices are expected to increase for non-EU citizens from 2026.
And there's been another major resignation at Opera Australia.
There has. The company's CEO, Fiona Allen, has stepped down after 3 years in the role. The move follows the departure of the artistic director, Joe Davies, who left Opera Australia last year, only 18 months into her contract. Despite its position as one of the preeminent arts companies in Australia, the organisation has reported millions of dollars of losses in recent years. Also on the horizon is a report commissioned by Creative Australia into Opera Australia's governance, which is due in coming months.
What else has been making waves?
Carla Sofia Gascón, who is nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars for her role in Amelia Paris, is in hot water after a series of old tweets resurfaced in recent days. The social media posts, which included offensive remarks about Islam, George Floyd, Chinese people, and criticisms of diversity at the Oscars, have led to both apologies and denials from the actress, neither of which are likely to have helped the film's chances at the awards.
She was going so well.
She was. Kendrick Lamar and Beyoncé were the big winners at the Grammys this week. Beyoncé won Album of the Year, her first, despite being the most awarded artist in history. Meanwhile, Kendrick took home 5 awards, including Best Record and Best Single, for his diss track against Drake, Not Like Us. Groove in the Moo joined Splendour in the Grass as yet another Australian music festival, which will sit out 2025 after cancelling in 2024. The author, Neil Gaiman, who has been the subject of multiple allegations of sexual assault, published by Tortoise Media and then Vulture, has now been named in a human trafficking lawsuit by accuser Scarlett Pavlovich. Gaiman's ex-wife, Amanda Palmer, is also named in the suit. Keith Galash, a beloved member of Australia's theatre scene, has died at the age of 80. Galash was a writer, dramaturg, editor, and performer who worked with theatres throughout the country and was the co-founder of the magazine Real Time. Valet to Keith, and valet as well to Marianne Faithfull, who's passed away at the age of 78. The British singer, songwriter, and actress reinvented herself multiple times throughout her career and worked with everyone from Godard to Metallica.
Oh, yeah, Marianne. So long, Marianne. There's an extended conversation from 1996 with Marianne Faithfull on the music show on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Morning sun touched lightly on the eyes of Lucy Jordan in a white suburban bedroom in a white suburban town.
You're listening to Arts in 30. I'm Daniel Browning. 2 years ago, The Australian published a story titled White Hands on Black Art, alleging that white studio assistants were interfering with the paintings of Indigenous artists at the APY Art Centre Collective. It was the first of a slew of articles and almost daily coverage. The claims led to the cancellation of a major exhibition at the National Gallery of Australia, some high-profile resignations, and four separate investigations, not to mention a chilling effect on sales, compromising the entire category of Aboriginal art. Last year, the ACCC cleared the Art Centre Collective of any wrongdoing. Now, the final investigation has concluded, with the Office of the Registrar of Indigenous Corporations, ORIC, deciding to take no further action. A spokesperson told the ABC that while they wouldn't comment on the details, no adverse inference should be drawn from the investigation ending. Gabriela Kozlovich is a freelance journalist and author who's been covering this story for the Saturday Paper and the Nine Papers. Gabriela, the final investigation, the ORIC investigation, wasn't a rubber stamp.
Absolutely not. I mean, ORIC can make really serious decisions. It can send people to jail, for example, and it has. Investigated Brett Evans, who was a long-standing manager of the Mornington Island Arts Centre, and the most famous artist from there is the fabulous Sally Gabori, who's been internationally acclaimed. He was a very good manager for a long time, but towards the end, he started selling her paintings while she was still alive and pocketing the money himself rather than distributing it to the artist, to her, and to the Art Centre, as is required by the Art Centre Terms of Business. And ORIC investigated and it went to, court, and Brett was sentenced to 4.5 years jail. So, ORIC is not just some rubber stamp. If there was something to find, it has the power to make some serious findings and to then prompt the next steps that can lead to jail time for managers of art centres or anyone who works in Indigenous organisations that have done the wrong thing.
What were the claims and what evidence existed for them?
The most serious allegation that was made back in April 2023 was that white art advisors or assistants were interfering with the art of Indigenous artists, not just on the lands, the APY lands, but also, widespread also in the Adelaide headquarters of the APY Art Centre Collective. The main evidence was a video, a secretly filmed, roughly 50-second video that was published by the Weekend Australian back in April 2023, which showed a white studio assistant painting on the canvas of an Aboriginal artist, a leading Aboriginal artist, Yarraji Young. And what was shocking to many people who saw this video was the white assistant was also talking about composition and should we put another rock hole here and should we put some more paint down there. So that was the main allegation, and the strongest evidence was this video that had been secretly filmed and then published in the Weekend Australian. And after that, there was a massive number of stories published by The Australian, more than 90 stories. And the allegations went beyond just white staff interfering, but also that the Arts Centre Collective, that the APY Arts Centre Collective was plagued by mismanagement and that there was the coercive control of Indigenous artists. And the focus of these allegations most forcefully was the general manager, Sky O'Mara. She came under a lot of heat for her particular management of that organisation, and her photograph was appearing very regularly in The Australian. It was quite a concerted effort against this organisation.
What was the response from the APY Art Centre Collective at the time?
All along, they've maintained that they've done nothing wrong and that the white art assistant was simply helping Yarraji Young, who's an older artist. I don't like to use the word elderly, but she is in her, I think now in her 70s. She had some physical issues And Rosie was helping her with certain parts of this very large canvas that Yarraji was working on. So the APY has always said these accusations are false, they're incorrect, and they're saying that they have now been vindicated with the fourth and final investigation into them finally released, and again, no findings have been made against them, nothing to see. No, they've done no wrong, according to the Office of the Registrar of Indigenous Corporations. So it's been, 2 years for the organisation, and during those 2 years, they have undergone 4 separate investigations, none of which have been able to nail anything on the organisation or on Sky O'Mara. As you remember, the organisation was set to have a really important exhibition, the Noora Pulka exhibition, at the National Gallery of Australia in June of 2023. But as soon as the allegations were published in the Weekend Australian, that exhibition was halted, and the National Gallery of Australia launched the first investigation into the APY Art Centre Collective, and that investigated 28 paintings that were going to be included in the Noora Pulka exhibition. And they were 28 huge new paintings by 3 generations of Anangu artists from the APY lands, including, Wynn Prize winner Zachariah Fielding. So the NGA organised it, but it was an independent investigation, and it was headed by 2 really prominent lawyers, Colin Golvin and Shane Simpson. And, after many months of investigation, they and their team delivered a 34-page report. And they found nothing. Well, they just said, the paintings were created by the artists. And that was widely reported. But nonetheless, the exhibition didn't go ahead. So that was the first investigation.
The impact was far-reaching. I mean, that exhibition at the National Gallery was well underway. It was not very far off from happening. Bruce McLean from the National Gallery was the curator. The kind of mud sticks, really, when you think about it, the impact it had on the careers of artists working in the APY lands, not just with the APYACC. I mean, it affected everybody working in the APY lands. In a sense, besmirched everyone's reputations. It was an extraordinary series of events which polluted the whole category of Indigenous art for a time.
Yes, I would agree with that summation. And it really affected many people deeply. I mean, you mentioned Bruce Johnson McLean. I interviewed him for the Saturday paper, and he said that his decision to leave the National Gallery of Australia was influenced by the media storm that surrounded the Noora Pulka exhibition and the APY lands artists. And yes, you're correct. I mean, I remember Bruce telling me that it was about 90% installed, and then all of a sudden it comes to this crashing halt because of these allegations. I mean, look, these are serious allegations. The video that the Australian published did look very concerning. So I think it was important for the National Gallery of Australia to investigate, and they did. But as Yarraji Young said to me, look, the Jukapa, no one can take that from us. It's in our songs, it's in our country, it's in everything. And also let's not be naive here. I mean, Indigenous artists also create for the market. These were some of the issues that were discussed as a result of this story. And I think Colin Golvin and his team and Shane Simpson and his team, their report is really worth reading. And they deal with this issue, and they talk about, ultimately it's about whether the artist has creative control. And Yarraji, when I spoke to her, said, I want the white art assistants to do this. They know how to work with me. I've taught them. I've been doing this for a long time. They know. And these are the issues that came out as a result of this. And they're important issues to discuss. Unfortunately, the manner in which they were discussed just created so much turmoil for these artists,
Gabriela Kozlovich is a freelance journalist, and you can find more on this story on the ABC website. There's a link on our show page. You're listening to Arts in 30, your weekly digest of global news in arts and culture. I'm Daniel Browning. This year's Hottest 100 featured the fewest Australian songs in almost three decades. Only two tracks made it into the top 10, and both of them were covers performed for Triple J's Like a Virgin. At the same time, we're continuing to hear that long-running music festivals are cancelled or taking a pause, and many small local venues across the country have raised concerns that they might not be able to stay open. What's happening to the Australian music scene? Joe Hardy is the co-founder of SydneyMusic.net. John Watson is an artist manager and the president of 11, a music company. Joe, first to you, is this Hottest 100 result just an unusual one-off, or is it part of a bigger trend, do you think?
Look, it's a really good question. I think it does seem to be part of a trend that's accelerated in the last few years, especially as the pandemic was a fairly significant event that sort of made a lot of effects more extreme right across the economy, the way we consume culture and art, the way we connect with people. I do think that we are seeing figures sort of blown out a little by that. But nonetheless, we're still seeing trends that have been taking place over a number of decades where there has been a slowly but then quickening decline in interest in local culture.
I suppose we had kind of a version of that when the lockout laws were introduced in New South Wales. So it's like COVID was a body blow.
Yeah, very much. And even before the lockout laws took place, we were observing a change in trends. So the slow disappearance of small venue live music was a really important indicator. And I would actually say that, and it's kind of ironic to say this in the current climate, but one of the threats to small venue live music at the time in the late 2000s in the first decade of this century is festivals. And they were actually sort of taking audiences away from local live music that was distributed across the broader suburbs of most of our metros and had a stronger presence in our regional centres. And instead, festivals became much more of a dominant, you know, fewer times a year for punters, but something that was a much more significant event on their calendar.
I'll stay with you, Joe. Triple J is still playing as much Australian music as ever.
That's right.
And the success of those Like a Virgin songs shows that they're still very influential. Why isn't more new Australian music cutting through?
Sure. I think it's got a lot to do with what people are tuned into. Like a Virgins are interesting because they tend to play on trends that are happening globally and are reflective of sort of the zeitgeist at that level. You're absolutely right. Triple J still plays a ton of Australian music. And if you compare their most played artists from last year to the Hottest 100, there are some really glaring differences. Psycho was their second most played artist last year. Did not make a showing in the top 100. The Boys from Sydney are an incredible local band that gig really hard and have a great local following. They were the 10th most played artist on Triple J last year and did not make the top 200. So it's clear that there is, in some respects, an aspect where Triple J's influence on audiences in terms of what they grab onto as their most significant cultural moments, there is a schism happening there, but it's sometimes hard to actually grasp at why that's taking place.
Now, John, a lot of the artists you represent are well-established, like Missy Higgins, Midnight Oil, Birds of Tokyo. Does this conversation still matter for artists of that kind of calibre, or is this just an issue for emerging artists?
I think there are issues definitely for Australian artists of all sorts. What we're happening at the moment is, it's been a 10-year trend at least, is that we have this gradual decline in new Australian music joining the Great Australian Songbook. Australian music is moving to the margins of Australian culture, and it's coincided directly with the rise of algorithmic programming based overseas. So whether that's Spotify or YouTube or TikTok, the places that people discover music are now primarily places which favour overseas content. And in previous decades, local content had a leg up, both in terms of artists being more easily able to access it, to go on and appear on TV shows and visit radio stations and so forth, and also in terms of the formal quotas the government's put in place. So if you like, Australian music used to have a head start and it now has a handicap, and that affects all Australian music and it affects Australian culture. You know, I think it's a really sad thing. We're going back to a period of the 50s and 60s where Australian music was through the margins of Australian culture. And, I'm glad that people are starting to focus on the issue, because it's been an issue for quite some time. The pandemic made it worse.
Now, what's Michael's rule and why does it matter in this case?
A problem this big has lots of causes and it therefore requires lots of solutions. One of the modest solutions that the Association of Artists Marriages has proposed is something called Michael's Rule, which is simply a undertaking by promoters to include Australian artists on international tours where possible. So when you go along to see Taylor Swift or you go along to see Ed Sheeran, you get to see an Australian artist as well. It's not saying there can't also be international artists on those bills. It's just saying that an Australian artist should have that opportunity, because that exposure exposes the artists to audiences in Australia. It gives them a story around the world. It also elevates their name recognition if they're on all the advertisement marketing for those shows. So another of the sort of long-term trends that is exacerbating the decline of consumption of Australian music is that more and more international tours are packaged out of Los Angeles or London with international artists. They arrive in Australia without scope for Australian artists to be on early in the day. And so Australian artists used to get a lot of exposure through being on these tours. That's increasingly not the case. And so Michael's Rule is simply a undertaking by the AAM to try and get promoters to give Australian artists an opportunity to be heard by Australian audiences when they're open for international artists.
You talked about discoverability and about that issue of the algorithms being based overseas. How can we then discover new Australian acts, whether it's on stage or in our headphones?
I think this is a real tragedy that we are losing voices that amplify our local music. We do, of course, have media properties like Triple J, like commercial radio, but the vehicles through which careers are made and documented and talked about and become part of the cultural conversation are becoming more and more limited. So we've seen a really dramatic erosion in media titles of all medias over the years. And the art is so good. Like, I've been really heavily involved in music in Australia for 20 years, and I've never been so excited by what's happening in the underground. It's just a connection thing. It's just about the cultural psyche of, you know, the mainstream and Australia in general. It's all out there, and it's happening in every suburb. It's just not visible right now.
John Watson is the president of 11, a music company, and Joe Hardy is the co-founder of SydneyMusic.net. Now, every week here on Arts in 30, I'll be joined by a music specialist from across the ABC to bring you the one track that you should be adding to your playlist. And this week, it's Casey Green from ABC Classic. What have you got for us, Casey?
Hey, so this week I am bringing you a track from London-based Belgian experimental / ambient jazz artist Nala Sanafro. So this track is called Continuum 9. It's off her latest album, Endlessness. This is her second album. And, you know, I'm being a bit cheeky. This is one track I'm recommending, but I really do recommend having a crack at the full album. As the name suggests, Endlessness, it's mystical, it's flowy. You know, all the tracks, some of the tracks blend together and link together seamlessly. So I think it's definitely best sampled this way. So her mother actually was a classical piano teacher, and her father has Caribbean roots and was a jazz saxophonist. So you can really hear that kind of blend of classical and jazz influences in her music. So she's a pedal harpist, a keyboardist, also has been known to play the bagpipes on some things. But in this track, she's playing modular synth, and she's joined by some contemporaries on sax and some more synths. So it's a really warbly, kind of beautiful, flowy, loopy kind of vibe. So here's Continuum 9 off the album Endlessness by Nala Sanafro. Thank you.
was Continual 9 by Nala Sinefro, the track chosen for us this week by our music correspondent, Tessie Green. Arts in 30 is produced by Sky Kirkham. Our executive producer is C. Benedict. Riley Mellis is our sound engineer. I'm Daniel Browning, and I'll be back with you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.